I think that our culture is so busy, we're just trying to get the little mouths fed and get our own mouths fed. You know, I'm tired, I gotta do this thing next, I'm taking a lunch break, I'm gonna eat this thing, microwave it and eat it sitting at my desk. Or the kids just got home from gymnastics practice and they're famished and we just gotta just push something that'll feed them so they're not starving to death. So I think it's just, we're backed into a corner a lot of times and we're not realizing the value of mealtime as a ritual that's a blessing to our families, not making the family table a place where we gather and, again, taste and see that the Lord is good, but tasting in a literal way and seeing that each other, others in our table are good. Mm-hmm. Enjoying that time. So shifting from this utilitarian task where people must be fed, therefore I must cook, to seeing it as a broader role of taking care of your household.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Feminine Glory Podcast. I'm one of the hosts of the Feminine Glory Podcast, Lydia Edmonds, and I'm joined by my delightful co-host, Esther Edmonds.
Hello, everyone.
We have a very special guest on the podcast today, so let's get right into it.
Alrighty, so today on the podcast, we have Angela Smith. Angela lives in Northeast Georgia with her husband and is a homeschool veteran of over 30 years. In addition to all things cooking and science, she's passionate about nature study. The forest is her happy place, and she can often be found there foraging mushrooms, photographing tiny critters, and enjoying the beauty of creation. We are delighted that she is joining us today. So Angela, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
We are delighted to have you. So first question, just to kick it off, is probably the biggest question we've ever asked on the podcast. So are you ready for this one?
I'm ready.
Okay. Do you think that the Georgia Bulldogs are going to win the national championship this year?
Oh, I would be a traitor if I said no. Of course we are. You got to go into it believing, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
I have scouting reports, but I know that, you know, we literally have a countdown calendar to football season in my house. And so, you know, I've got to stand behind our dogs.
That's awesome. So in light of game day coming up, what are your favorite game day snacks?
Well, in our house, we do gather on game days at my house. Okay. And so it has to have one of two requirements. It either has to clog your arteries or it has to be crunchy. So fortunately, a lot of vegetables are crunchy. So we always have a vegetable platter, usually with some kind of dipping option. But a lot of us eat it naked because we know we're going to overindulge on the other stuff. We do a lot of smoked proteins. My husband loves to smoke pork. So I don't actually pull pork because I prefer it chopped. So I'll say we'll do smoked pork butts and then do that as you would pulled pork.
Yum.
We do smoked brisket. He smokes salmon sometimes.
Ooh, yum.
We do all the wings.
Yes.
We are living in the middle of a wing zone here in the Southeast. So you can get a lot of good wings if you want to purchase them out. We cook them a lot. I like to do lemon pepper wings. Sometimes we'll do teriyaki wings. My husband also smokes wings. The drawback to that is that the skin doesn't get as crispy as it does with some other preparations when it's smoked, but you gain a lot in flavor when the meat is smoked. We do jalapeno poppers.
Yes.
However, I'm not a heat seeker. I want hot peppers so badly. I want the flavor, but I just can't take the heat. So this year in my garden, I am growing a variety of poblano that's about the size of a jalapeno.
Smart.
So I'm getting a nice harvest saved up, and we're going to do poblano poppers this year for the rest of us that can't take the heat of jalapenos. And I know jalapeno is like a baby heat pepper. So it doesn't even get up there with the ghost peppers and the Carolina Reapers or anything like that. And then eat all kinds of chips and dips. We love to do the chips and I've got a dip that I make called Old South Dip. That's a recipe from a restaurant in Arkansas. Sometimes just mixing cream cheese and salsa or any of the little baked dips. So your typical fare, you know, we'll do carnitas or chili, and sometimes it comes chili dogs and Frito pies. So these are sometimes treats.
Well, that all sounds delicious.
Oh, yes. And I'll have to hear how the poblano poppers end up turning out, because we definitely tried jalapeno, but then there are some in our family that doesn't like heat. And so that would be really interesting to know. I've never thought about that.
I'll post that on Instagram and let you know how that turned out.
Sounds
awesome.
Great.
Awesome.
So you have a company called Inquisicook.
Yes.
So when and why did you start it? And maybe tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. Well, Inquisit Cook started as an idea in the late 1990s. We homeschooled all the way through until our last child went to college. And about this time, our youngest daughter came to me and said she wanted to do cooking for one of her homeschool classes. And we were already cooking together just as part of our family life and, you know, hospitality. But she wanted it to be an official homeschool course. And I had been reading some books by Dr. Jay Adams, and one of those was Christian Living in the Home. Okay. And in that book, he highlights the fact that some of the things that we look at as drudgery would not be drudgery if we had better understanding of them. And cooking was one of those things he highlighted. Like, if you understood, like, what's actually going on the molecular level or with the chemistry when you're doing these things, you would have more creativity and you would enjoy the process more and would have more control over your outcomes. So this converged with her asking to do cooking. It's like, okay, we'll do that, but we're going to do the science of cooking. I had always wondered why in like the elementary sciences, things tended to focus so much on abstract concepts for young students like zebras and volcanoes that they'll never see, at least probably mm-hmm. not in the days of their youth. I don't have anything against zebras and volcanoes. They're fine to study, but we've got all this science that's literally under their noses on their fork that we mm-hmm. could be exploring. So that's how it started, and I thought I was just going to go to libraries, bookstores, homeschool conventions, and buy some things and make it happen, and there was just nothing like this available, and since I couldn't find it, I decided to create it. So I didn't get it done in time for her, but I got it done in time for the grandkids, and they're some of my best cookie buddies now.
How fun.
That is amazing. And just to, like, I mean, that had to have taken a lot of hard work even, too, just to, like, you know, you do all the research and then to put together all of that curriculum. And if go ahead.
It took me a long time to actually get going. I had to finish homeschooling my kids, and then we had a cross-country move, also moving back to our home state of Georgia. But then when all the kids were gone and the grandkids were starting to get settled in, that was my time. So I wasn't working on it all that time, but it did take a lot of effort and a lot of years to kind of piece it all together.
And you recently released another set, right? Like a part two?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Got Inquisicook 1 and Inquisicook 2. And between those two courses, it's a very broad foundation of culinary skills. You should be able to put a lot of things on the family table with the science and the culinary skills that are covered in those two. And we've got Inquisicook Junior that's currently in production for younger students.
Oh, how amazing.
I think that I love that idea, that model, because I feel like teaching kids to cook is definitely a lost art that not everybody does nowadays. And if you understand the science behind it, that, you know, opens a pathway for a lot of creativity.
Yes, exactly.
So why was it important to you to teach your children in particular to cook?
Well, a few different reasons. I mean, number one, older women likewise are to teach younger women things, right? Mm-hmm. I won't go into the whole verse, but you get the idea of what I'm saying. We're supposed to be passing down these skills to our kids. But specifically teaching just children in general, we've got a few things going on in our culture. We're losing the grasp on where our food comes from. There are a lot of kids that have no idea that spinach is a leaf of a plant, or, you know, what part of the plant is a celery stalk, or that chicken actually came from an animal. I was teaching a group of homeschoolers, and we were doing boiled eggs. We were going to devil eggs that day. And in this very fine group of lovely, intelligent young women, all of them were amazed at what happened when you peeled that boiled egg, that it was solid. I mean, isn't that not weird?
That is very weird.
Wonderful homes that enjoyed food, but I guess that the boiled eggs that they had eaten came from a grocery store already boiled.
Wow.
And to see that transformation from this egg that was raw to this solid thing that you could peel and it would stay in one piece was amazing to them. So there's like big gaps that you wouldn't think about.
Absolutely.
I see flavor palettes also kind of narrowing as we've eaten more and more processed foods, and we love those Cheetos and the chicken nuggets and the pudding cups and different things like that. I think there are a lot of more flavor aversions, like, oh, I don't like that, I don't like that. I only want chicken nuggets, or I only want macaroni and cheese. And so I think when you give kids some agency in that process and some ownership, they're a lot more open to trying different things. And I think that also just there's the them coming up less dependent on convenience foods, but also well prepared for hospitality and able to make the most of what's available to them. So instead of just, I've got this thing that's always available, I always go to the same grocery store, you know, being agile, you have to learn skills to do that. And that needs to start at a young age.
How did you personally involve your own children in the kitchen?
It was just organic. It was just the things that I needed help with. If I was making, let's say, a casserole, somebody needed to grate the cheese. Somebody needed to chop the onions. Somebody else needed to, you know, grease the pan or, you know, cut up the vegetables that were going in it. So, you know, just parting out and saying, okay, you take a turn with this, you do that. While I was cooking and still kind of orchestrating the whole thing, it made it not a big deal. You know, you obviously have to match the skills with the maturity and abilities of the kid. But, you know, you've had them all their lives. You should kind of have an idea of what their fine motor skills are and, you know, who's going to make a hot mess of something and who's going to be okay to be less supervised. And so just bringing them along, there's no substitute for deliberate practice, just day to day. Getting the kids in the kitchen and learning how to chop an onion and learning the safe way to grate cheese on a box grater and learning how to fold egg whites, foams, and things like that. You can't just one day wake up and say, okay, now we're going to learn all the things. Right. I mean, you can, but it's much harder.
I saw on your Instagram account, you had posted a picture of a little girl. It looked like maybe making a pizza. And you were talking about how important it is to get your children involved in the kitchen. And it may be more time now, but then that's no replacement for what you can produce later on in the child's life and all the skills that you can teach them in the now. And it is basically putting an investment into your children. And I thought that was such a great way to put that, because I think, and maybe you can hit on this if you want to, it seems like the women in America now don't seem to think that as much. It's kind of just get the meal on the table as quickly as possible with, and so they're not thinking of the kids for the future.
Right. So that's a picture of my granddaughter. We have our 12th grandchild is due any day now.
Congratulations.
Congrats.
If they're within proximity of me, and several of them are, we get them into the kitchen when they're toddlers. We have a little stand-up stool that they stand on, and we just bring them into the process. And sometimes they're just, you know, putting the raisins on top of things, or, you know, in that picture, she's putting the pepperoni on top of the pizza, but she also spread the sauce and she helped with the stretching of the dough and the rest of it too. So I just like for them to know that the kitchen is a welcoming place. It is in our house. It's the absolute hub of the household. And I think it is for a lot of families. And to let them know that they're welcome in there, that there are some boundaries that they need to respect, but like, this is a place where you belong and you can contribute, even if you're little bitty.
Do you think, does it seem to be that from the start they enjoy it early on?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously most toddlers like to play with Play-Doh, but so it's like a real life version of playing with Play-Doh, you know, instead of pretending to grate the cheese with a grater with Play-Doh, you're actually grating the cheese, you know,
right.
Pretending to chop up apples, you know, you get them some safety knives and let them chop up apples. And they just see it as so much fun. And it's, you know, it's engaging all of the senses. So we're hardwired to enjoy things that we can smell and taste and hear and feel. You know, that tactile experience really attracts kids into the kitchen. And if we don't push them away, they will almost certainly enjoy it.
I love that.
So do you have a favorite memory of working in the kitchen with your children?
Probably my favorite memory is an annual one, is our the lead up to Thanksgiving. So we're very experimental in our Christmas menu, but Thanksgiving is always the same.
Okay.
This is by edict of my husband. We do not stray out. We don't do anything weird on Thanksgiving.
Okay.
So there is a cadence to the week of preparation. Okay. On Monday, we bake the cornbread because that cornbread has to sit and get stale in order to be turned into the stuffing that is going to be prepared on Wednesday night to be put into the bird on Thursday morning. You know, we do the cranberry relish on Tuesday because those flavors develop over the next few days. We do the pie crusts on Tuesday also because we're going to bake the pies on Wednesday. So there's this buildup of the cooking process where it's all hands on deck. Within that, the anticipation of the feast and the thankfulness and the celebration. So it's like it's not just the cooking. It's the emotional, spiritual ascent that leads to Thanksgiving that to me is so precious.
Oh, that is so fun.
Oh, you go ahead.
We have a tradition with our mom. It started a while back. We had a baking business, and we stay up really late the night before working on all of the pies. So there's six people in our family right now. So we make everyone their favorite pie. So we'll stay up and bake like six different pies. We'll have like chocolate chest, the pumpkin.
Coconut cream.
Yeah. And then the fun thing about that is you get to have the pie for breakfast the following morning.
Yes.
Oh, that's a great idea. Because you wanted to start with pie anyway. You see the pie sitting there.
Absolutely.
Do you have a favorite pie?
Oh, I would. It's hard to say. I think certainly pecan pie would.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah. Yes, that's the one I look forward to. And I love pumpkin pie, too. I actually love all the pies. But pecan pie, to me, it's so decadent. Yes. And, you know, you only get it a couple times a year. Mm-hmm. And that first bite, if it's well made, is just heavenly.
That's a awesome. Good one.
So what are some ways that mothers could deter their children from wanting to be in the kitchen, and how can they actively avoid doing that?
So I think fear of misses is a big one. They're for sure going to make one if they're little. Mm. Like if you're making cookies and they're dumping the flour in, some of the flour is going to get on your counter. If they're stirring, some of it's going to slosh over. You've got to make peace with that. You're making an investment in time together and in teaching skills. And if you think back to when you first learned to cook, as an adult, you're looking back, like you didn't stir perfectly the first time you were stirring something or whisking eggs or trying to fold something into whipped cream or whatever it is. You made messes. That's how you learn to control your movements to not make a mess, is by getting in there and saying, oh, if I do that, it's going to slosh over here. If I dump the flour from way up here, it's going to make a big splat. So some of that you can tell them as you go along and just like adjust their little hands and say, let's hold this low so it doesn't make as big a mess. But you've got to be okay with the mess. Mm-hmm. The other thing is fear of injury, I think, is a good thing to an extent. But, you know, if you're cooking, you're probably going to cut your finger from time to time. You might burn your wrist when you're putting something into the oven. You want to do what you can to avoid that and teach them safe practices. But if you hover over them in a way that keeps them from learning to do the actual activities, they're not going to be comfortable. They're not going to be confident. So I say supervise with wisdom, but don't hover.
Do you think... Oh, I'm sorry.
And finally, I was going to say, just be okay with imperfect results. It won't be okay. If they overmix the meatloaf because they just love squishing that raw meat between their fingers or whatever it is, you know, you can tell them next time, let's don't do that. But be okay with it and don't make a big deal out of it.
Do you think sometimes if people are hovering, it puts like a lack of trust into the kid? Like they don't think that the parent doesn't trust them to do the task?
Oh yeah, I think definitely so. Like, and then they know they're being watched, you know, and it makes them less comfortable. If I don't cut this celery piece to the right, you know, to the right length, I'm going to get caught type of thing. So I think we should try to encourage kids to do the best that they can. I mean, if they're obviously just being sloppy and lazy, that's a bigger problem than what's fixing to happen on the table. Yeah. But if you can see that they're really trying their best, just, you know, try to give it some grace. Mm.
Do you think that there is such a thing as a theology of cooking? And if so, could you explain it and the importance of it?
I do think that there is such a thing as the theology of cooking. I've heard people speak on this subject and been awed by how smart and spiritual they are. Well, I wish I was as smart and spiritual as you are. For me, I think it's more of a convergence of theology and cooking. Like, I can't really separate them because it's, if you are a spiritually minded person, that's going to spill over into all areas of your life. Mm-hmm. So when I'm cooking, especially if I'm hosting and I love to show hospitality, well, there's this whole thing of sharing and communion and tasting and seeing that the Lord is good and, you know, working with your hands, that comes into just the mindset of preparing food and then feeding others and the spiritual idea of us being fed, that all comes into play. And then there are so many specific examples of food in the Bible, you know, the symbolic importance of oil or the symbolic importance of smoke. Thinking about, you know, the yeast of the Pharisees, or a little yeast works its way through the entire lump, all these things. When your mind is drawn to these things as you're cooking. And I do some of my best thinking while I'm just doing some kind of mindless labor that I've done a million times. I think of like smoking proteins. You probably know people who smoke proteins. You probably are related to people who do. So smoking is like, it's almost like a religion around here. But if you think about the burnt offerings, the Old Testament system, and like the pieces of meat being put over an open flame, and then that fat, as the heat is applied to it, begins to render, and the fat drips down onto the heat source. And when you understand the science of this, it becomes even more meaningful, because then the fat hits the heat source. Maybe it's wood, maybe it's live fire, maybe it's charcoal or whatever. Then it vaporizes, and it sends up flavor compounds that are reintroduced to that piece of meat. So those flavor molecules become reattached to that piece of meat as the heat currents carry them upward. And when you read through the Old Testament sacrifices and things, and you're like, ah, oh, and you know, you can smell your neighbors when they're barbecuing also, that's that aroma wafting up and that offering to the Lord. I can't look at a piece of meat that's being smoked and not think about that. Mm-hmm. So it's the interplay is, I can't set it aside.
Do you have a favorite analogy in scripture regarding food? That's like, would it be the sacrifices that's your favorite?
I think that's the most powerful one, because you're hearing the sizzle, you can smell it, you can see it, you can see the little tss when it goes up. And when we think of our prayers being an offering to the Lord, it marries in perfectly to me, and it excites the senses.
It really does. Yeah. Whenever we walk out, and it's like, it's an unmistakable smell, and you're just like, oh, I know what that is. And it smells like home. It smells like food. It smells like comfort.
Yes. Yes. And your mouth starts to water.
Involved. Yes. Yes. So suppose that a woman hasn't been taught to be a creative cook. What are some practical tips that you have to help her develop food creativity in the kitchen?
I would say educate yourself on the functions of the food in the recipe. Why is this thing in this recipe? And that's going to take some effort. I can give you some book recommendations that you can check out. Once you figure out which parts are essential and which parts are negotiable, you can make judgment calls on what you do with food. So, for instance, a lot of times people, they want to make a sugar-free version of a baked good. And so they just grab a sugar substitute, whether it's Splenda 1-for-1 or Equal or whatever it is. But sugar is functioning as a lot more than a sweetener in a lot of baked goods. Sometimes it's just there to give a sweet flavor, but so many more times it is adding structure, and it's adding, especially if it caramelizes in the cooking process, it's coating the food with a flavorful coating that's not just about adding sweetness. Same thing if you learn about the functions of eggs in recipes and all the different tricks that they play. If you've got an egg allergy, then you can figure out, what can I substitute for these eggs in this application versus that application? Sometimes the eggs really have to be there and you just need to choose a different recipe. I mean, I wouldn't want to try to make flan without eggs. But sometimes you can substitute something completely that you would never think of. especially when it comes to baked goods and things like that. So learn how those ingredients are functioning in the recipes, and that'll be the first step towards bridging out.
So it's not just as simple as Googling it and then looking up the AI response and then just substituting it.
Well, that's copycatting. So there's nothing wrong with that. I do plenty of copycatting myself, but it's not really creativity if you are just mimicking what somebody else has done. There's nothing wrong with that, but you're missing the fun part. You're missing the part that tickles the part of your brain that wants to create, that wants to be artistic and express yourself and share part of yourself with others.
So what would be some of those book recommendations?
So anything by Cooks Illustrated is pretty good. They have one called The Science of Cooking, and then they have one called Cook's Science. Those are both really good. And they, any recipe in these books or other books that start off explaining why this recipe works, that's your flag to let you know that there's going to be some science going on in there, even if they aren't using scientific terms. Mm-hmm. So those two books are really good. Shirley Corriher is a food scientist that wrote for Fine Cooking for years. She also appears on some Good Eats episodes. She has two James Beard award-winning books that follow that same kind of format, that tell you why it works, tell you the functions of the ingredients. One is called, let me look on my shelf here. One is called, I can't see it on my shelf. It's a really simple title. Oh, Bakewise. Yeah, one's called Bakewise, and one's called Cookwise. So one is specifically about baking, and one is a broader approach to cooking. Kenji Lopez Alt has a book called The Food Lab. It's a good bit nerdier, but it's really good stuff, and it's huge. That might be one to check out from the library first. And then if you really want to have a good reference resource on the science of cooking, Harold McGee has a book called On Food and Cooking. He is kind of the godfather of science for the home cook, and that book is indispensable if this is something you really want to explore.
That's awesome. So in America today, it seems that women have lost, speaking of creativity, the creativity of using spices while they are cooking. One way that this is seen is in our reliance on ready-made spice blends sold at the grocery stores. When and why do you think that began, and was it a simple reliance on the ease of things like spice blends or something else entirely?
I think there's a combination of reasons.
Okay.
So when this began, to my knowledge, and I just had to think back to when I was writing about this, during the colonial era of the British Empire, Brits developed a taste for curry. Well, there is no spice called curry powder. That's a spice blend, right? And they tried to replicate that curry powder, that curry blend, and because it takes a lot of skill and a lot of experience to know how to tweak that, curry powder came into being, and you could buy tins of curry powder. So that's, to my knowledge, the first instance that I'm aware of where there was a spice blend available, where you, instead of buying individual spices and blending them yourselves. I think in post-World War II, after the women had entered the workforce and stepped away from the home for a while, there was a desire to, they saw that there were some liberties from the so-called drudgery of the kitchen, and they did not want to let go of that. They wanted to have more freedom, to be outside of the kitchen. And so a lot of convenience foods started to come to the forefront, you know, TV dinners and things like that. A lot of factories, from what I understand, that were used in the military efforts for production of things that the military needed were converted to convenience food factories.
Wow.
So I've got a book on my shelf that talks about some of that kind of thing. So there was this desire to not be a slave to the kitchen. There was the repurposing of those facilities. And then also I think for modern times, like right now, one of the challenges in setting up a household is buying all of those spices. Curating a collection of spices where if you're reading a recipe, oh, I don't have cardamom, or what on earth is an Aleppo pepper, or even basic things like cinnamon or ground ginger, those little tins are expensive if you're trying to build a pantry. And I think a lot of times people are just kind of thrown into needing to get started. And it's just easier to buy a spice blend. And it's kind of a shame because you do take away your ability to adjust it to your taste. And then eventually, you know, as we keep shifting from ingredients to processed foods or packaged foods, we're losing the knowledge of how to actually blend the spices, mm-hmm. how to toast the spices, how to bloom the spices, how to grind the spices with a mortar and pestle or whatever it is. If it always just comes to you as, oh, this is a Montreal steak seasoning, or here's a McCormick packet of chili seasoning. It's a mystery pouch to you, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and you might be able to make chili with that chili seasoning pouch, but you certainly wouldn't be able to do it without it, without some additional education.
Do you think it would be beneficial for us to kind of go back to where we grow herbs and things to put into our food?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yes. And really, there's almost no excuse for it. Not now, because you can buy them in the grocery store in little pots. Mm-hmm. You know, in the winter, I can't grow basil in my garden in the winter. So I go to Trader Joe's and get the ones that are already growing and I snip my herbs off of that. But if you've even just got a front porch that you can put a pot on and you can stick herbs in that pot, I always tell people, if you can't grow anything else in your garden, grow herbs, because they're very expensive to purchase kind of fresh varieties at the grocery store, as far as that come in the little clamshells. And it's very hard to get them at their peak. I had to cut down my rosemary plant of many years last year, and it was painful for me to have to buy fresh rosemary after having bushels of it for years. So if just a little bit of space and a tiny bit of care, you can have fresh herbs right at your fingertips.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that part of maybe why the moving away from being creative with the spices is maybe why we don't really have a culture as far as food goes in America?
I think that's a big part of it. I think that once the society starts forgetting how to do things, if there's an easier option, they're probably going to take that option. Mm-hmm. So as long as Hamburger Helper is available and everybody's too busy to learn how to actually manipulate spices and work with them handily, they're going to be inclined to grab that Hamburger Helper. Even though they know that it's more expensive and it's got other stuff in there that they would prefer not to show up on the plate. We teach this in InquisiCook. We have a unit on herbs, spices, and seasonings because we want students to understand like the role of salt. The salt does more than just seasoning, but it's a rock star when it comes to seasoning. We want students to know the difference between tender and woody herbs. We want them to know where spices come from and how they are best used and how they're best combined. You can find a lot of that stuff online if you just do a little spice 101. And get reacquainted and get mini tins. Some of these spice suppliers will sell just small containers of spices. Maybe you don't need 3 ounces of ground ginger. You can just get a tiny thing and start slow and start building your knowledge library.
Mm. So you mentioned you had a book on your shelf about the culture and how it changed with the spices. Would you mind giving us, if you have the title off the top of your head?
I think it's called Something from the Oven.
Okay.
I should have brought these books over here before we started. I believe it's called Something from the Oven.
Okay, perfect. I'll have to look into that book. It sounds so fascinating.
And there's another companion to it that's called Perfection Salad.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, that also sounds very interesting. I'll have to go and get these books.
So kind of continuing along the creativity line, some women can just absolutely nail the creative part of cooking, but they don't seem to really care about how the food is presented. How important do you believe food presentation is when it comes to actually partaking of the meal?
Well, I hate to use a cliche, but you do eat with your eyes first, right?
Yes.
If it just comes to you as a brown pile in a bowl with no color variation and no form to it, and it just looks like mush, you're not going to be as excited to eat it. Now, there are times when, it's a bowl of oatmeal and we've got to go. There are other times, though, and I think most of the time, it only takes a few seconds usually to make something look better than as if it was just splatted on a plate. So I do think it's important. I think it conveys care and love when you take the time to put a sprig of something or a sprinkling of something or you slice it neatly, even putting it in the right serving vessel. Like if you serve something where the sauce is a big component of the eating experience and you serve it on a flat plate and all that sauce just goes into a thin puddle, you really can't scrape that into the main component of the dish. But if you do a shallow bowl where they can maybe tilt the bowl and do all that, the vessel that you serve in has a big role in how that food is enjoyed. And this is one of the areas when it comes to like spectacular presentations, I do copycat. I'll Google and see how are other people styling this particular dish. Mm-hmm. And then I'll borrow from their inspiration. Sometimes I'll do it exactly. And sometimes I'll just use it as a starting point and say, okay, I can do that. But then I'm going to branch out in these other areas. But just adding a little color, a little textural variation, something to break up the monotony of the plate, or something that to make it beautiful. Like I love edible flowers. And you put an edible flower on anything and I'm in.
Do you think part of the reason it doesn't seem like a lot of people care about food presentation all the time. Do you think that just goes back to ease, or that women just don't seem to understand about making things beautiful anymore?
I think that our culture is so busy, we're just trying to get the little mouths fed and get our own mouths fed. You know, I'm tired. I got to do this thing next. I'm taking a lunch break. I'm going to eat this thing, microwave it, and eat it sitting at my desk. Or the kids just got home from gymnastics practice and they're famished and we just got to just push something that'll feed them so they're not starving to death. So I think it's just we're backed into a corner a lot of times and we're not realizing the value of mealtime as a ritual that's a blessing to our families, not making the family table a place where we gather. And again, taste and see that the Lord is good, but tasting in a literal way and seeing that, that each other others in our table are good. Mm-hmm. So enjoying that time. So shifting from this utilitarian task where people must be fed, therefore I must cook, to seeing it as a broader role of taking care of your household.
Mm-hmm. Yes, going back to that investment we were talking about earlier.
Exactly.
So if somebody, let's say they do that, they take your advice and then they decide to make mealtime a priority, let's just say even if it's just dinner and they're going to start with making dinner nicer and table fellowship, what would be the fruit then when the kids get older that you think could be a part of that?
Well, I think once you establish that as a ritual, you can maintain it as a ritual when they get older, when they get so busy and they get their first jobs and they've got to go to a soccer game, or maybe if they've got a boyfriend or a girlfriend, they are going to be much more inclined to respect that ritual as a part of the family structure and plan their lives around it. And that's your connection time. That's when you find out what went on in their day. You tell them about what happened in your day, anything that they're struggling with. You rejoice in their victories. Talk about things that are coming up that your family needs to be thinking about. Hey, so-and-so's birthday is coming up. What would be a good gift? If you make that part of the fabric of your family life, there's an ongoing connection that your kids are not going to walk away from as easily. And hopefully they'll establish that within their own families. Because, I mean, again, the trend is like, okay, got the kids from daycare, put this one in the high chair, microwave some chicken nuggets, and then we can do a bath, and then, okay, read a book, and you're just trying to get through the tasks instead of, it's like, this is life. The thing we're doing right now is the thing we should be doing. Mm-hmm. Not just get on to the next task.
Would you say also that emphasizing table fellowship when they're young and just kind of in the everyday or as much as possible would then also contribute to, like, in holiday seasons when it's like we're feasting, it's a moment of feasting, that contributes to like a more fun time for everyone then as well?
Oh, definitely. Yes. I mean, even something like just church fellowships or, when you have a pattern of setting times when you relax and enjoy each other's company, and you're not just trying to get food in your belly, it definitely carries over and will bring anticipation, or just having people over for Sunday lunch or for Friday evening, a cocktail party or something like that, for adults, obviously. But it makes an event out of something that you're going to do anyway.
Mm,
Yes. So there is a practice of eating / cooking called seasonal eating. For those who may not know what that practice is, could you explain what it is as well as your thoughts on it?
Sure. Well, our food, the food that grows out of the ground, we'll say, grows in specific seasons. So some foods grow in the spring, or we'll say are mature enough to eat in the spring. And so those tend to be tender pods, tender shoots, berries, like strawberries, early berries, lettuces, you know, some spinaches, things like that. Other foods, they grow into larger fruits like watermelons, bell peppers, tomatoes. Those are going to happen in the summer. The fall vegetables, the what we call winter vegetables, winter squashes, pumpkins, and then it goes, you know, the apples and pears. And then you've got hardy greens like kale and collards that will stand up to even a hard freeze a lot of times. So food is at its best when it's in its season. So okay. It's most nutritious, it's most flavorful, and it's most economical. So you can get collard greens in December at a very low price. They're very nutritious, they're very fresh. And I'll just introduce the environmental component as a factor of being good stewards of creation. Mm. If you're eating food that's closer to you, that's from your area, and it has not traveled 1,000 miles to get to you, and used a lot of fossil fuels to do that, and you know, possibly produced some pollution, it's just a better deal for the earth. We want to take care of creation. So this is not a political soapbox that I get on at all. I sometimes enjoy strawberries in February, but it comes at a quality cost. So the berries that you get in February in the grocery store, we actually have some information on this on our website. They are going to have a much starchier interior. It's going to be tougher. They're not going to be as juicy, and they're not going to be as flavorful. Now, they look beautiful because they're engineered to look beautiful and to stand up to long haul distances. But that comes at a cost. And so if you can eat the things that are already at the farm stands around where you live, and that's going to vary depending on where you live, mm-hmm. You're going to do yourself a favor. You're going to do your pocketbook a favor, be better for your health, and it will be better care of creation. And it's just so darn tasty.
Yes. Yes, it is. Now, there's nothing quite like a tomato fresh out of the garden.
Absolutely.
Do you think that there's something that that the way obviously that God created it would be very ordered, very intricate. Do you think that relates to kind of like your health as far as what you'd need in that season?
Oh, I definitely do. Yeah. I think that like a lot of a lot of the fruiting vegetables and things like that, they're going to have a sugar content that'll give you a little, you know, it'll hydrate you because they're moister and it'll give you a little burst of energy. Versus some of the lighter fare, the leafy greens of winter are not going to be quite as nutrient dense, although you can, you know, bring in other things that are. I think that the genius of creation and in agriculture is worth exploring because it's pretty amazing. And there are all these foods that just go beautifully together. I mean, tomatoes and basil, come on.
Yes.
You know, it's no answer. Oh, yes. These things are at their prime at the same time, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, when you like plant a garden, like the companion planting, that gives you a hint of what goes together.
Yes.
As far as a meal goes.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Perfect example.
So as a woman who is very knowledgeable when it comes to food science, what are your thoughts on plant-based foods?
I'm very eager to hear this answer.
It kind of has me scratching my head, I will admit. I do not... Food preferences and dietary ideologies are a sacred cow that I try not to step on because we deal with a lot of food sensitivities, a lot of food concerns in the industry that we work in. Everything from, you know, folks who want to eat vegan to gluten-free to seed oils and food colorings and things like that. And I think people should eat what they want to eat and serve their families what they want to serve their families. The plant-based thing, there's a side of it that's peculiar to me because so much of the food that's in the plant-based industry is trying to mimic foods that are not plant-based. Mm-hmm. And so you've got hot dogs that are made out of pea proteins and all these strange things. I mean, there's nothing strange about pea protein necessarily, but, you know, basically the components are extracted and then reformulated and then put back together, and then they're molded and colored and all. And then you got this hot dog that doesn't have any meat in it, or whatever it is. You've got vegan bacon or Impossible burgers and stuff like that. So I get it that if you're trying to move from eating meat, you might want something that replicates meat to an extent. Personally, I would just rather eat the vegetables. Like, I love chickpeas. I think they're wonderful. I don't necessarily need them formed into something that looks like something other than it is. Mm-hmm. Because all of that usually involves hyper-processing the food. So there's a lot more just manufacturing that goes into it, and then the packaging and the molding. Whereas just chickpeas, you can flavor them in so many different ways, and they're delicious. Mm-hmm. So I'm skeptical about processed foods that are plant-based and trying to look like something that they're not. I'm sure that if I was trying to go vegan, I would be thankful for them, because I would definitely have a hard time giving up burgers. So I get it. I get why people want them. It's mm-hmm. not for me. A lot of times when I see the stuff in the store, it just makes me think I would not want to eat that. But, you know, I guess there are some people that have reasons, some of them ideological and some of them metabolic, for making that choice. But yeah, I would just rather have the real food in its real form. Less processed is better. And the interesting thing is, like, a lot of people that would venerate these plant-based miracles would turn their nose up at Velveeta, which is actually probably a lot less processed.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what do you, hypocrisy there?
Yes. So what do you think led to the development of plant-based foods, or then also like where that seems to be, I don't think trendy is quite the right word, but there seems to be a lot of people that are doing the vegan or the keto. Like, what do you think? Is it just the quality of food in America is really causing problems for people, or what do you think is the tie-in?
I personally think it's ideological. I think that, the hyper-environmentalism, as far as which crops are thirsty crops, and, you know, the CO2 emissions of cows and the methane gas and all that, you know, you can get this many calories per acre if you grow these things and eat them rather than raising a cow or a pig or what have you. I also, the animal rights aspect of it can't be ignored. I think that's a very large component. I think there are some that really are seeking the health benefits of having less cholesterol and more fiber and things like that. But I think a lot of it is driven culturally through the more ideological driving factors. Mm.
Do you think, I've had various people tell me that, obviously for certain, medical reasons that they've been advised to remove a certain grouping of foods. So like, for instance, like don't eat kale, don't eat this. And I, obviously there are people that have their own medical issues and they can decide for their own situations. But do you think there could be a potential danger if you omit certain food groups like meat from your diet?
I mean, I'm no nutritionist, but I think that, you know, variety is in our diets is would be the top choice, to eat a variety of different foods and eat them in moderation, eat them seasonally if you can, so you get the most nutrition that you can from it. But I obviously, if you're omitting meat, you have to take other steps to make sure you're getting adequate protein, whether that's in combining foods to form a complete protein, or taking a protein supplement or something like that. I don't know that many people that eliminate fruits and vegetables for health reasons, but they're probably out there. Maybe even if they just get indigestion or something like that. I think you have to be careful when you say no to an entire food group without good cause. Now, mm-hmm. if your doctor has said you must not do this, or you absolutely should do this, that's a different thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So speaking of trends, what is a kitchen/food trend that you just can't get behind, and why?
I'll give you two.
Okay.
I'll give you one for adults.
Okay.
Stunt food that you see on TikTok drives me crazy, where people are just doing outrageous things with food, putting weird stuff in waffle irons, dumping strange combinations into crock pots and then telling you how great the results are, making mega batches of macaroni and cheese actually in their kitchen sink. I saw one video where a woman was making a nacho bar literally on her kitchen island with no platters or anything, just dumping all the stuff, and then poured a big number 10 can of cheese sauce all over it.
No.
And lettuce at it.
It
grosses me out so much. My son knows how I hate it, so he'll send me clips of it from time to time. Mom, we have to teach these people to do better. So, yeah, I cannot find, like, I don't want to make flaming hot Cheeto weird stuff. No, please no. So that's for adults. The food trend I can't get behind for kids is some of the subscription cooking boxes. Now, some of them are really good quality, so I'm not lumping them all together. The ones that I object to are what I call the dump and stir subscription boxes. Okay. So they show up. There are pouches of mystery ingredients in there. You don't know what they are. The kids don't know what they are, but, you know, they tear them open and they pour them in a bowl and then they stir and then they're cooking and it's STEM. And it's like, okay, what have they learned? Mm. They're not actually learning any cooking skills. They're not even learning what those ingredients are that are being presented in those final products. They can't replicate it because they don't sell those mystery pouches at the grocery store, right? Mm, yes. So they've not actually learned how to prepare a dish that they can replicate. Mm. And it's, you know, they're expensive and they're usually junky food. And so I dump and stir subscription boxes are a hard no for me.
Mm. That's just more so like you took up their time than you really taught them anything.
Yeah. Right. I mean, and they're having fun. They're stirring and they're calming and they're whatever. And then they're eating this thing, you know, it's usually something sweet, usually carby sweet stuff. If you're just wanting a fun activity, okay, but don't fool yourself about what's being learned.
One look at your Instagram account, and it is clear that you are not following what some would call the tradwife trend of food preparation, in which women take a simple and minimalistic approach to cooking. Do you think that this trend is a potential pitfall for women when it comes to food preparation, and if so, why?
Well, yeah, I think it's, you can potentially just tamp down your creativity, venerate simplicity to the point that you're not even trying to up your game, mm-hmm. so to speak. So, I mean, obviously we need to be moderate in our elaboration and match the effort to the particular event. But I think that, you know, Edith Schaefer's book, The Hidden Art of Homemaking, was a pivotal volume for me. Mm-hmm. When I saw that you can have artistry in everything that you do within your home, and you can put self-expression in the way that you put flowers in a vase or the way that you arrange the silverware on your table. For me, like, just all the little things, like my dishwashing liquid, how do I have to keep that in the dishwashing liquid bottle, or could I put that in a glass bottle that's pretty to look at? All those things are opportunities to surround yourself with things that make you happy and mm-hmm. kind of make you feel at peace. And glad to be in your own home. It's the same thing with you, the foods that you prepare. You can just add your own personal twist, your own personality, put a little bit more thought into it. A lot of times it's not that much more effort. It's a matter of just giving it some thought. Mm-hmm. And then it's such a blessing to the people that you're serving to know that you've gone just a little bit, given just a little bit extra, a little bit more than what you had to.
Mm-hmm. And it's like, when you're talking, it reminded me about like the parable of the talents. Don't bury your talent, like, yes. Give it back to God, glorified, do something with it.
Exactly. Yes. And it's, the kitchen is a great opportunity for that.
Mm. So we've talked a lot about creativity. Why do you think it would be important for someone if they're like, I think creativity is great, but I'm just not a creative person? What do you think, how do you think that being creative helps a person in general, would you say? Why would you think it'd be important to be creative?
Well, I think on a spiritual level, we are exhibiting the characteristics of our maker. Mm. Our maker is the ultimate creator, right? And he has given us all an element of creativity in some way. Even if you can't paint paintings, even if you can't, you don't embroider, flower arranging, it doesn't usually work out for you. There's something within you that wants to create. And like leaning into that and finding your voice with it, so to speak, like just think about, just look at it, just take baby steps. Like, I'm going to do something different with this. And if there are detractors whispering in your ear, just tell them, hey, give me some space. I'm going to try this out. Just try it. You might be surprised at how well it works out. And if you try it and it doesn't work out, do a post, a post-mortem on the situation and figure out what went wrong and see how you can do it better next time. It's like, don't miss the opportunity. Don't miss the opportunity to turn something that you're doing anyway into a creative outlet. Like, and don't be hard on yourself. Mm.
I think it was going back to Yehuda Schaefer's book. She mentioned somewhere in there, and I thought this was so great, that being creative helps you become a more interesting of a personality type. And I think that's so great, because then, you know so much, and now you can be really interesting and talk to several different people, because it's like you've tried so many different things.
Yeah. And I think that goes back to a lot of just thinking about things. Like, if you're thinking things through, you will be a more interesting person because you've given some thought to stuff. You have more to say because you've considered it ahead of time. You become more conversant. So I just taking the time to think through things is a big part of it.
Speaking of conversing, if you could have tea or coffee with any woman from history, who would it be and why?
That is such a tough question. So many women in history. Think so many women. I'm obviously women in the Bible that would have so much to offer in terms of wisdom and inspiration. But as I think about somebody that I feel like I could actually approach in a conversation and that it would still be a profitable conversation, I think Elizabeth Elliot.
Yes.
She's a fascinating woman who's lived a fascinating life. She suffered hardships. She stayed the course. But do you ever have music that, like, when that music comes on, you're just at peace?
Yes.
You know, a particular, maybe it's a hymn or maybe it's a classical piece or maybe it's something that's currently on the radio. But when that comes on, you're just, your soul is at rest. Mm-hmm. When I read something written by Elizabeth Elliot, it puts me at ease. And I get this feeling that everything's going to be okay, even if it doesn't look like it's going to be okay. So I feel like she's so approachable that I could actually have a conversation with her. That's the feeling I get from her writing anyway. I wouldn't just be sitting there kind of gobsmacked. she would be able to, I think she would be able to speak so much wisdom to me over a cup of tea that it would be a delight.
And it's such practical wisdom. It's not like, beyond me or anything. It's like, oh my goodness, it's right there in scripture. And it's so simple, but like, it's just laid out beautifully. And she's definitely been a big help. I know, like, in my early teen years, I read a lot of her books and it was a big help for me as well.
Yay.
Do you have a favorite book by her?
Well, I have just been rereading one. It's been renamed. It's called Discipline, the Glad Surrender.
Okay.
And it's just exactly what you mentioned. It's just like little pointers, like little obvious things on becoming a more disciplined person. Mm-hmm. And so that one for me, obviously I'm rereading it. So it had a good impact. And I think it's so accessible that, if I read some of the Puritan writings, I'm like, this is amazing, but my brain is so full.
Yes. Oh, yes.
So I feel like those are kind of snacks that I can partake of without, having to sit down to a big feast of information.
Mm. So going back to songs, if your life had a soundtrack, what would be one song on it?
I'm going to say Summer Breeze by Seals and Crofts.
Okay.
Yeah, too young for that one. It came out when I was a kid. But okay. That song is almost like an exact snapshot of my life. It's me and my husband. We're empty nesters now. But we just enjoy the simple things in life together. Mm-hmm. Every evening when he comes home, we go out on the deck and we just have a time together. He has a glass of scotch. I have a glass of wine. We kind of recount our days to each other. Give the narrative of what's gone on. We talk about what's coming up. Sometimes we're talking about physical things that need to be done. Oh, it's time to plant the turnips or whatever. Sometimes we're talking about spiritual stuff. And sometimes we're just laughing and thinking back on memories. But like enjoying the simplicity of our life together, especially since it is summertime, that's the one that came to mind. It's just like just relaxing and enjoying each other's company and enjoying the fellowship and enjoying living in this place in the summertime.
That's so sweet.
I love that.
Do you have a favorite wine?
Do I have a favorite wine?
Yes.
Yes. I like Sauvignon Blanc.
Okay.
I like a nice, crisp, dry, light wine.
We'll have to get that for our mom. She loves wine. So,
what's your mom's favorite?
Ooh.
I think there's one called, it's like Robert Mondavi or something like that. It's the red wine or whatever. I think that's one of her top favorites.
Yeah. Robert Mondavi Cabernet Sauvignon is really good too. I like Cab Sauv also, but
that's great.
So what is something that has stood out to you recently that has captured the essence of feminine glory?
I don't know if this is exactly what you're looking for, but there is an Instagram account called The Bramble Vine. I don't know.
Okay.
Free Vestal.
Yes. Yes.
So I think the stuff that she does, especially she does palette knife painting on cakes where she frosts cakes, that they look almost like impressionist paintings.
Oh, wow.
They're just spectacular. I want to learn how to do it so badly. And then she does this very intricate painting on cookies that look like the Dutch. I can't remember what the Dutch pottery is, the blue and white pottery. They are just so sweet.
Yes.
And so homey and so beautiful, but they're so ephemeral. These masterpieces are being created for a baby shower or a child's birthday or, you know, some special occasion. So she's blessing people with this artistry, this creativity that she has. Mm. And she's willing to do that for something that's going to be cut into slices or eaten very shortly. So I think that sacrifice of spending that time to create something so beautiful and so delicious to make others feel special is really the essence of what expressing feminine glory is.
Mm. Yeah, I love that because, I mean, most people would look at that and just be like, well, it's going to get eaten in like 5 seconds, so I'm not going to take the time to do all that. But yeah, she does beautiful work. It's amazing.
Yeah, I'm very envious.
Well, Angela, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been fantastic.
Oh, thank you, ladies. I've had so much fun.
We have too. It went by too fast.
It did.
It always goes by too fast.
Time flies.
Oh, yes. All right. Well, thank you for coming on. And until next time, pursue feminine glory. And we will see you on the next episode of the Feminine Glory Podcast.
Bye, guys.
Bye. That was such a great interview.
Oh my word, it really was.
She is a wealth of knowledge.
I loved it.
So great.
If you loved this interview as much as we did and you want to see more that Angela is doing at Inquisicook, such as blog posts, or you're interested in signing up your kids for the curriculum, head over to Inquisicook.com or check out her Instagram page at Inquisicook. Well, everyone, thank you for joining us on this episode of the Feminine Glory Podcast. This is the part of the podcast where we're supposed to tell you to like and subscribe to our YouTube channel or just subscribe to Apple Podcasts, but particularly YouTube. So there you go. You can smash those buttons and...
Or you don't have to. If you find us boring, if you don't like us, you can
just
not do that and not visit this podcast again. It's up to you. Would you rather...
So...
To listen or not to listen, to subscribe or not to subscribe.
That's the question.
Yep. So you can pick. You can pick. We'll leave it open.
Yes.
You can subscribe. We like YouTube.
Yeah.
Because it hosts our podcast. So.
And YouTube would like us to ask you to do this. So.
So there you go. We asked. So you can do that. Do that what you will.
We'll see you on the next one.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe.
Who knows? All right. Bye, guys.